This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Oliver Rader, his new book is Seven Games, A Human History. The story of seven games and the computers who envy the games and are conquering the games and maybe the future, especially in chess. We're headed to something entirely new in the solar system, half human, half the other thing, called a centaur. But we begin with Oliver at 9 years old in Baldwin, Iowa, he tells me, on his grandfather's farm, where he is learning the game of chess. And at nine, he defeats his grandfather, or as I suspect, his grandfather lets him win. Oliver, what was the magic? You talk about a Proustian moment. It wasn't for you a cookie. It was a game of chess in Iowa. How did it first strike you? Can you recover that feeling?
Well, small correction. That was a hard-fought, legitimate victory because my grandfather, Grandpa Jack, famously had an inviolable policy of never letting kids win. So I had lost to him dozens, if not hundreds of times from a very, very young age. And this was a victory, John, years in the making. So I'll just put that out there. This playing chess with my grandpa and other family members was my first exposure to games. And yes, as I write in the chapter that played on this very specific sort of chessboard on this farm that had been in the family for decades, and that's what I think of without fail when I think of chess. And I think sort of what captured me about games and about chess then, I hope I capture in turn in the book, which is, you know, one thing is the sort of democratizing force of games. Like, you know, there's not a lot of things with which I could compete with adults on exactly level terms, right? There weren't a lot of activities that adults were doing that I was also doing, but games were one of them. And yeah, ways to come to a good excuse to come together with family, an excuse to get lost in something, to read deeply about something. And games are, as I write in the book, a number of times, games are these sort of small slices of the real world that allow us to practice and to strive and to struggle. And I really admired that about chess, and I've come to admire that in mini games, and indeed in the seven games that I discuss in the book.
Oliver's research takes us to India about 1,500 years ago, what might be the beginning of chess, although there's always debate on this. The players on the board resembled parts of the Indian army. More interesting is, well, and there are wonderful anecdotes about it being that old, but is to come to the 18th century, about 300 years ago, 200 years ago, the Mechanical Turk. This is ambition to turn chess into a machine that can play humans. What was the Mechanical Turk, Oliver?
Yeah, the Mechanical Turk was an automaton, just sort of a robot developed by Wolfgang von Kempelen, who was this sort of court engineer in Austria-Hungary. And in the 1700s, automatons were all the rage. There were automatons that played the trumpet. There was a duck automaton that ate and did what ducks do after eating. Automatons were a huge fad. So this was sort of the ultimate automaton, a robot that could play chess completely mechanically, this very intricate machine. And it played, you know, members of court in front of, you know, the empress and beat them. And it was this wholly impressive machine. And I hope, needless to say, given that this was the 1700s, it was a complete sham. There was a chess player hiding in the inner workings of this machine, controlling the robot's arms and so on. But nevertheless, wonderfully impressive machine and design, and sort of captured this idea of, well, could a machine do something intellectual, i.e. play chess, better than a human? So even though the Mechanical Turk itself didn't, it sort of set off this centuries-long series of events that resulted in the answer being yes, indeed, a machine can play chess and do other intellectual endeavors better than the best human can.
The Mechanical Turk burned in Philadelphia in 1854, I learned from Oliver. We come to the 20th century, mid-20th century. Very famous people, Claude Shannon and Alan Turing, asking the question here in the U.S. and then everywhere, can machines think? And now we come into serious business, because at the same time they're asking that question, they're inventing a machine that we call a computer. And by the mid-50s, I follow Oliver's reporting, they'd conquered enough to play on a 6x6 board, but not the whole machine. It wasn't until the late 20th century that a couple of programs out of Pittsburgh, out of Carnegie Mellon, High Tech and Chip Test, take us into what we remember now from the late 20th century as IBM's Deep Blue. The question of inventing a computer for chess, what is the challenge for all of these inventions finally to play Kasparov in the late 20th century?
Yeah, the main challenge, why this is difficult and literally took centuries, is just has everything to do with the mathematical depth of chess. So imagine, you know, the first move of chess, you only have a handful of options, and then your opponent has a handful of options. And you can imagine this handful, every move sort of branching off like branches and eventually twigs of a tree. So every sort of the end point on this tree is a possible game of chess. Well, in chess, there are more of these endpoints than there are atoms in the entire universe. There's incomprehensibly large number of possible games. And computers don't have the benefit of, say, intuition or this sort of, you know, intuitive idea of, oh, this is the best path up the tree, or that looks like the best path up the tree. Rather, these computers have to climb the tree and calculate over and over, calculate, is this a good chess position? And then move to another branch. Is this a good chess position? And as I mentioned, the tree is so tall and so thick that you need computers that only existed essentially in the late 20th century, as you say, culminating eventually with quite literally a supercomputer, one of the fastest computers in the world at the time. It took to perform these searches and these calculations quickly enough to defeat Garry Kasparov in 1997. And indeed, that was less known, as that was Deep Blue's second try. IBM had challenged Kasparov in 1996 as well, but Kasparov fended off that challenge, only to lose in 1997. And nowadays, as of course computers have gotten even faster and even better, and software has gotten faster and more efficient, the top human would stand absolutely no chance against even a free app running on your iPhone. So the gap has grown.
Hence, I learned from you, Oliver, that we now have something new in the solar system. Centaur. What is that?
So, as I mentioned, there was this sort of classic way to get computers to play chess, which was to have them just search and evaluate, this very rote process. But now there's efforts to make computers sort of, I hesitate to use this phrase, but more human, sort of more intuitive. And beyond that, many people argue, including Garry Kasparov himself, that more powerful than any computer is a human alongside a computer. So Kasparov has argued for something called what he calls advanced chess, this idea that, you know, I will sit here with my computer and you, John, will sit there with your computer and we'll play against each other. And that, he argues, and many others agree, will produce, you know, the finest chess imaginable, this idea of sort of merging man, human, and machine. But I should say also that the chess played by the top computers nowadays is sort of incomprehensible to humans. It's we know it's good, it's demonstrably good, but sort of its moves are not something we'll ever sort of hope, we can ever really hope to replicate. And indeed, many observers call this sort of alien, like it plays like an alien might. And we know it's good, but we don't really understand why.
If you want to watch this alien play, it's called Stockfish or something close to Stockfish. And it plays all the time. Oliver's led me to a site that is addictive. It's TCEC/chess.com. You watch two programs play against each other endlessly and make moves that I can't imagine what they are before they show me. So we come to, we leave chess behind, inventing Centaur, and we go back many centuries, 24, 23 centuries BCE, certainly third and second century BCE, to the game of Go, a game that is not about taking a fortress, a king, but it's about surrounding your opponent. I mentioned to Oliver that I read an article in the New York Times in, I think it was 1968, during the Vietnam War. And the analysis was the Americans play chess and the Vietnamese play Go. And it burned in my mind, so I tried Go after that, and I failed completely to understand the game. I see now why. At the Princeton School for Advanced Studies, the game became a fascination to Einstein, Turing, John Nash. Good heavens, everybody, major league, was playing this. The game of Go today, where is it played most decidedly, Oliver?
Go is extremely popular in the East. Its origins are Chinese, very popular in China, Japan, Korea. Some of the strongest players in the world are from those countries. And, you know, in that part of the world, Go occupies sort of the same cultural space that chess does in the West. And there's sort of two games are sort of both bound up with ideas of sort of intelligence and these sort of pinnacle intellectual pursuits. And yeah, Go is most often traced, you know, roughly 5,000 years old, and similar to chess, sort of thought to have been invented as a sort of miniaturized military exercise, this idea where you could sort of plan and practice strategy and tactics. But indeed, yeah, there are important aesthetic differences between chess and Go. Go is, in some senses, the most complicated game that humans play with any regularity. Mathematically speaking, I mentioned earlier this chess tree and how complicated it is. I mean, Go is orders of magnitude more complicated than chess. But Go is also starkly simple. There's only one type of piece. I have black stones and you have white stones. And there's only one type of move. We place the piece somewhere on the board. And that's it. I mean, you could learn the rules of Go, I think, in a couple of minutes. But it's the interactions of these simple rules that create this enormous and beautiful complexity, just like the interactions of laws of physics create enormous complexity of the real world. And this idea of what's called emergence from these very, very simple rules emerges this game that, you know, can fascinate us for literally for millennia.
And there is a program called AlphaGo. Is that the most recent version? AlphaGo that can defeat the world's best human, Lee Sedol, in 2016.
Yeah, that's right. So AlphaGo and then later AlphaZero, which is the same idea but extendable to other games beyond Go, came out of a company called DeepMind, which is owned by Google, sort of Google's AI outfit. And yeah, it took AI outfit of a $1 trillion company to beat the best Go player in the world, which I think is testament to the brilliance of the human mind. But yeah, in 2016, again, this was a feat thought to be decades away. Go, like Bridge we were discussing earlier, Go was thought to be sort of the sole domain of humans. It required intuition, and it wasn't subject to the sort of raw calculations that were successful by computers and chess. But again, this sort of history repeats itself. Lee Sedol lost to AlphaGo in 2016 and promptly resigned from the game, the sort of sad end to this story. He realized, he said at the time, that he was not the strongest Go playing entity in the universe and indeed never could be. And for him, this was an important part of playing the game was to achieve that.
I recommend you reading Oliver's chapter on Go first, because it comes to this move made by AlphaGo on the 37th chance that flabbergasted everybody watching because it was so creative. It's an unusual word, but that's the one that was described at the time. We're going to turn to games much closer to home, to friendly checkers, and then a mystery to me, backgammon, a very old game. This is Oliver Rader's story of seven games, a human history. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.